Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
What are we, 14? Is this 14?
Yeah, I think this
is all right.
Our 14th episode.
So, welcome to the 14th episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. I got it on the first try. It only took us 15...
Oh, the balloons and confetti are coming down from the ceiling.
It only took me 14 tries. But as usual, I'm Kyuan Hong with my co-host Rob Lockhart.
Hello.
And our special guest tonight...
Ashlyn Sparrow.
Hello.
So this is, I literally met you 5 minutes ago.
That's very true. Yes.
Yeah.
Ashlyn is the director of the Game Changer Lab at University of Chicago.
True.
Which makes games for impact.
True.
And
I just
most,
imagine getting punched in the face when I walked in.
Yes. Those, that kind of games for impact.
Awesome.
Like variants on boxing and Muay Thai.
And falcon punches. Because of space.
Games that change people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
That's the attempt. So.
Or so, prevents people's lives.
That's also
in terms of,
kind of true.
Yeah,
because
there's like a strong focus, I'd say, on sexual and reproductive health.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
And so contraception would be a big part of that.
Yeah. So preventing people from having children if they do not want to have children.
Gotcha.
So they're just knowledgeable about their choices in life.
So we always do like a little history segment. So how did you kind of end up where you're at?
At Game Changer, or just generally as a game designer?
Start from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in a small town.
That's also very accurate. Of 6,000 people called Farrell,
that
Pennsylvania.
Is a small town. That
but
is
if you combine the other towns, it's like 50,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it feel a little bit more significant. But essentially, my dad actually bought me a PlayStation for my birthday. I was
okay.
11.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to play Final Fantasy VIII. So I will actually say, for the record, I prefer Final Fantasy VIII over Final Fantasy VII, but I'll still play Final Fantasy VII.
Boy.
Very controversial.
You just lost a lot of listeners.
But I would. But yes, probably. I'm sorry.
It's okay. We don't need them.
Yeah.
It's an election year. Everyone hates everyone anyway.
Exactly. But I think after playing that game and I saw like the opening cutscene and played the game for a couple of hours, it made me want to be... I won't say game designer because I didn't know what that was
mm-hmm.
at that moment. I just said, oh, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when and what that was at the time, what I thought anyway, was being an artist.
Right.
So I taught
mm-hmm.
myself how to draw and like a lot. And I'm still really into anime, but I drew a lot of anime characters and taught myself how to draw. And once I got into college... I realized I don't want to draw for the rest of my life. But I'm a decent artist. And it wasn't until college and I joined the game design club where I was like, game design,
this is what you're looking
at. Systems.
Mm-hmm. Much
this
better.
Is it.
When you draw, you neither win nor lose.
Exactly.
So.
And I'm trying to, like, I'm always fighting a war with the computer and code. And so that's really where my passion lies.
Mm-hmm.
Since I
fight
studied
the good fight.
Yeah, information technology.
Okay.
So I was just like coding. I'm like, okay, this is it. This is where I want to be at.
Right on.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I got into game design. And it wasn't until I finished my master's in entertainment technology where one of my professors said, hey, the University of Chicago is looking for a game designer. And they're like apparently working on like games for like social good or something.
Mm.
You seem like that's something you want to do. And I was like, why not try? And it was one of the few interviews where I felt really comfortable
mm-hmm.
Talking about social issues. And then they hired me for some reason.
Right
and
on.
I've been there for 3 years.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
We do a lot of these like very specific Venn diagrams. So I feel that you happen to be like in the perfect intersection of those two Venn diagrams.
Awesome.
At the time.
Cool.
Tell me more about like the mission of your lab and what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so we are ultimately trying to meet students where they're currently at. We know that
okay.
The majority of high school students Yeah, schools, exactly. Like, majority of students play games. Mm-hmm. There is some research, and you can find it on the internet, but, like, 97% of youth play games. And so, since that's what they currently do, we thought that why not meet them where they're at, but also use it for educational purposes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Make it more engaging than just reading a book or having someone just talk to you for 50 minutes. Why not engage in something? Why not you figure out things on your own? Our co-founder is Dr. Melissa Gilliam, so she's a gynecologist.
Okay.
And the other co-founder is actually Dr. Patrick Jagoda, who's an assistant professor in English.
Yeah.
And so the two of them are taking their very distinct perspectives and smashing it together, and so that's how GCC came to be. So board games, card games. We even work with digital games, but we mainly stay with board games and card games since we're working with Chicago Public Schools.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of budget for tech, so mm-hmm. we want to make sure it's very low tech.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the mission. Building curriculum, teaching them game design.
You did an ARG, though, at one point.
We did. And yeah, so we've done two ARGs, alternate reality games. And so we did one in 2013 called The Source. And so essentially we had 140 students all on the University of Chicago campus helping this one girl find her father. And the father left a whole bunch of clues to his daughter, Adia. And so she outsourced that to all these students to help. And so each week we focused on a different, letter of STEM, science, tech, engineering, and math. And then the second summer program, so this was in 2014, we did Project Seed, which is my personal favorite, where we told 70 Chicago students that the world was going to end.
Okay.
And one of you will be the world's end, and the other 69 of you have to stop it from happening. And so this is actually one way that we got them to study, different, apocalyptic endings of the world, and have them actually debate about it, because we only had the bandwidth to send one of them to the future, of course. Mm-hmm. So debate, fight to the death, but not really, with words, with words.
This is like a reverse Terminator scenario, right?
Yes, exactly.
Instead of sending someone back in time to save the person, you go in the future to get rid of the one person who's going to end the world.
Exactly.
Or at least be able to predict it.
Right.
Yes, though the catch of all that was in the future, they were trying to use this for evil. So they wanted us to give them that, and it, led to a whole bunch of spiraling.
So, in the course of determining what the most likely doomsday was, that was playing into their hands, because they would then use that information to actually trigger that doomsday scenario?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which, it was water depletion. That was the one that won the debate and required us in the second week to redesign everything. He's like, oh, water depletion won. We thought it would be pandemics, it was not the case. So we're like, redesign everything based off what the youth just said.
Huh. Yeah, the joy of interactive experiences,
joy. Invisible theater and all that good stuff.
So how do you set, as a game designer, how do you set something like this up? I honestly have no idea. It's definitely outside of what I do, so.
Yeah, so because we're always thinking about the educational purposes, we work really closely with researchers. And so every project we do, we have certain learning objectives. So we knew that for Project Seed, that we wanted what's known as 21st century literacies. So we wanted our students to develop leadership, communication skills, collaboration skills. And so we, as the game designers, created an arc for that. So we said, all right, in the first week, they're going to focus on communication. That'll be the first step. And also getting to know their team members.
Mm-hmm.
In the second week, we're going to really build up their cooperation. So get them to work within their teams, but also start getting them more comfortable with the other teams that are there. And then the last week, we're going to develop their leadership skills so that there's going to be a serious pushback between the game designers and the students, and they're going to take control of the game. So we set that up in the first in the first couple months when we were pre-designing this, so that we designed our games around that arc. Mm. So we kept things, especially for the second and third weeks, a little content agnostic, because depending on what the students actually did would change how we would have to react to the story. Mm. So we just kind of wrote up a story that would support almost any type of gameplay. So sci-fi requires us not to have to worry about anything that's happening currently, because, you know, whatever. But would also allow us to really get them involved in, like, you know, science. Right. And also really worked well with the popular, like, YA novels that are happening, dystopian YA novels. So Divergent is, like, super popular. Hunger Games, exactly. So we were on that same bandwagon. Gotcha. So that's kind of how we started designing.
And they're all dystopic. So dystopic.
And ours was kind of two. Yeah. But what was nice is that instead of having, like, one person save the day, we had 70 students work together to fight back against the temporal archivists, who were the ones who were in control of the future.
So something that I'm wondering is, you know, when I build a game, right, I can beta test it by sending it out to, you know, like 10 people and having them play it. Do you do any type of beta testing, or is it just you kind of throw it out and see what happens?
For a 70-person game.
Yeah.
For an ARG, there is no real beta test.
Right, there's no way you can do that, right?
Yeah, the only thing that we can beta test are the small activities that we have planned, like very specific games. So, for instance, in our summer programs, we create a bunch of board games because we're trying to figure out how can we engage 70 students from 9 to 3, Monday through Friday, for somewhere between 3 to 5 weeks, depending on the summer program. So we need tools to be able to engage them. So we do our best to balance board games that we create. So we have Hexacago board game. So it's the map of Chicago with hexagons on it. And so we'll test that with some youth. We are partnered with the Lab School, which is a University of Chicago high school.
Okay.
And, you know, just to make sure that things are balanced. So we can test things like that.
So you test, like, smaller components.
Smaller components. We test board games and card games, small components. But overarching the structure of it, the narrative, cannot be beta tested. It's just kind of, you kind of just go and see what happens. So the most important aspect that the designers have to have is actually flexibility and comfort in role play.
Okay.
And then you just kind of...
So this is the improv happens. Thing where you say yes and...
Exactly. That's exactly it. Because if you say no but, it just does not work out. Mm-hmm. And what's
That's
nice...
That's just true of life.
Yeah.
Well, I know a lot
nobody
of
wants
people
to talk
people,
to
yeah.
no but people.
Exactly. And what's nice is that, like, what I love about ARGs is that it requires trust with your audience. Because we believe fully that these high school students are intelligent beings, and they are going to figure out where and how to break this world that we've constructed. There have been many times where students have figured out who I was and Googled my name and found my website, and they're like, "You are not Dr. Fermi. You are lying to me right now. What the heck is quantum botany?" And we're like, don't worry about that, little Timmy.
We're just throwing you off.
Yeah, we're just throwing
red
you off.
Red herring.
Exactly. Or we play into that and say, look, we're here because, you know, we're trying to take down these people, right? And so it's another story that's being told. And one of the best things that we can actually say is, you know what? I don't know. And that causes a whole bunch of other questions. So.
I'm curious how projects get started within Game Changer. Like, do you start with a mandate from, like, some funding that you got, or are you coming up with ideas and pitching them to Melissa or to Patrick, or how does it work?
So currently the structure is coming from, like, grants. Melissa or Patrick will come up with an idea, and then we'll go and apply for funding for that and write up grants. And then based off of if we get the grants or not, because we're completely grant funded. So there's, like, times where we're applying for 6-7 grants every single couple months. Mm-hmm. And depending on what gets accepted, then we'll start working on those projects. And so actually, this year, what we're currently working on is figuring out ways to better integrate research and design, because there's tension there, because these are two separate fields that have their own methodologies. And what we're trying to do is something radically different. There aren't many game researchers out there, and there aren't too many like educational game developers out there. There's a small handful, and so how do we start bridging that gap? And so now we're thinking of ways like, okay, can the game designers come up with game ideas that could be researched? How do game designers get comfortable with the idea of research? How do researchers get comfortable with the idea of games and what they can do, and the motivations behind why players play those games? So we're coming up with new ways to pitch ideas. But currently it's coming from Patrick and Melissa Grants, and then
right on. The researcher and developer thing makes me think of a new journal just came out from MIT, and I can't remember the name of it, but Kevin Slavin, do you know who that is? He used to be at Area Code, which was the Eric Zimmerman's game studio, and now he is a games like researcher person. But not, I would say, more a games person than a researcher. Even though it's like, you know what I'm saying? So, like, not that quantitative. But the mission of that new journal, which this whole conversation would be so much better if I knew the name of it. what is basically that is, like, sort of trying to figure out how designers and scientists can work together in an interdisciplinary way. And there's been some recent evidence of how not to do it, right? With the example that comes to mind is Lumosity.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah,
so they were advertised as like brain training games.
Yeah.
Right.
And they said that they were sort of, you know, research informed. And they are research informed, but the results of the tests of the games themselves is not backed up by research. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It's obviously tricky. This company that was very well funded totally got it wrong, or maybe it was on purpose. We don't know.
So speaking of research, I'm curious, because when we talk with like entrepreneurs, right, when we ask them how their game's doing, they're always talking about sales, right? And obviously that doesn't apply to you. How do you judge where something's like successful or not?
Right, and so that kind of goes back to that tension between research and game design and trying to solve that, because we fundamentally have two different metrics of success.
Right.
For research, it's really seeing if they can... And I say they as if I'm not a part of that, so I'm just going to say we, because I do claim
research.
I am part of research. But it's trying to change attitudes and behaviors and social norms.
Right.
And so we usually do like a pre-test and a post-test after people play the game and see if, you know, things change. So if they're saying like, I'm less likely to do this, or I'm more likely to do this. So that's the metric of success in terms of research. But then in terms of games, you know, we might not think about, oh, attitudes, norms, behavior, why are we quantifying this? How do people feel when they play these games?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are they engaged when we create an arc? Are they happy when we are trying to create a situation such that they are happy, that they should be happy? Are they talking to their friends about this?
Yeah.
Or are people willing to play this in their spare time? Right, but that also implies that this is an ongoing experience, that this is not meant for like school, right? So it's actually very hard, and we're still trying to figure that out, and we're still trying to build that shared vocabulary of how do we actually measure success,
right?
So I actually can't answer that question because we're still trying still to figure that out.
Right. Yeah, it's part of the ongoing process.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, one of the questions that you always have as a game designer is like, is this fun? And fun is such a difficult metric to hit.
Hate that term.
Fun. It's like, do you measure how long someone looks at the screen, how long they play, if they buy things or not? It's on so many different levels, mm-hmm. right? So, and clearly your medium is very different than mine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mine, you know, I'm looking at, you know, just data in terms of the way someone's manipulating a screen,
mm-hmm.
whereas I think yours is more just observing,
manipulating
behavior.
The ideas that you're
right
incepting into their brains.
Exactly. But also I'm curious about how, again, to like merge the two, I think that it's important to be able to look at like the data that they're manipulating on the screen, and seeing how, like, what their strategies are in the games, as well as seeing how their attitudes and behaviors shift.
Right.
I fundamentally believe that people will only learn what they want to learn. And when a person plays a game, like if I in like GTA have the goal of like, you know, hijacking a bus and just driving it around, I'm going to learn how
becoming
to...
Becoming a bus driver, just pick up passengers.
Right, exactly. Like, I have learned how to hijack this bus, but if the learning objective was to do something else, well,
mm-hmm.
my goal was already different from the goal of the designer.
Yeah.
And so how do you merge the two together to see the outcomes?
Right.
Is what I'm ultimately fascinated in.
Yeah, it's an interesting part about being a designer is, and especially as we discussed, it's an interactive medium, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can say the goal is to do X, but yeah, sometimes you just want to, you know, see how many buses you can hijack in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
A lot of what we do, I think, is meta design. It's not even
mm-hmm.
design. It's like designing a system that designs itself.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what are the boundaries of that, the space it's allowed to explore, the system?
Mm-hmm. And what emergent behaviors come from that. Even emergent narratives and
mm-hmm.
how that can support what the player wants. But also really, if we're going to try and, again, change attitudes and behaviors, then those are the things that we have to consider, game design
right.
methodologies
mm-hmm.
and frameworks. But it's a completely different field. It might not have what's known as like rigor compared to what a biomedical researcher might classify as research.
Right.
And so then the question is, well, what do you do? How do you make the best experience for learning possible?
So based off the broad kind of metrics you've talked about, is there something you feel that you've done that has been like just a home run success? Or on the flip side, something that just didn't work?
Mm.
That you said, like, this we thought it would be a great idea and it just didn't pan out. Yeah.
There have been a couple of card games, one specifically where we were trying to teach students about STIs, and
mm-hmm. everyone who played the card game got syphilis.
Which is actually true.
What?
No.
Last time I'm playing cards ever.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, but we were trying to make them heroes in this game, and they were trying to help other citizens fight off these STIs, and it was kind of this strange thought where people are like, do I have the STI?
Mm.
Or like, oh, and they would like laugh when someone else got like, oh, haha, you got a syphilis card. But they weren't actually playing as the characters who had the STI. They were playing as a hero who was helping the citizen. So
I see.
It was very weird, very messy, very
It's
strange.
Almost like colonial, you know, like, let's help these,
yeah.
these poor souls that...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there was a disconnect there.
There was a huge disconnect, and we also tried to incorporate like stigma into the game and fear or all these. It was just,
huh.
It was just horrible. there was no way to save that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even.
That's an important skill, knowing when to cut
yeah.
and run. To...
Absolutely. It's one thing that in my grad program they call, don't be afraid to kill your babies.
Yes.
Yes.
You just,
mm-hmm.
just kill them. They gotta die.
Yeah, that's a common theme that we've talked about a lot
yeah.
on here. I mean, it sounds bad when we say we talk about killing babies a lot, but...
Yeah.
They're metaphorical babies.
Yeah, metaphorical babies.
Metaphorical game.
And real babies. Good gravy. What about a home run?
A home run. So I still...
I mean, maybe it's too early to tell for some of them, because they're still in reproductive age.
Right, and also still, like...
Some of your students that have been affected, like, reach menopause, and they're good to go.
Look at you. You feel empowered in life. I think what I would classify as a home run is, like, the relationships I've built with my high school students. Mm-hmm. And, like, one thing that I got from last summer program was... A couple of students said, you know what? I didn't know that adults could be as cool as you guys. And it was a weird moment where I'm like, wait, am I an adult? Well, I guess I am. Oh, yeah. And so it's just like being able to relate to them, and they respect us. And I don't know. It's just this really nice relationship. So it's not necessarily a game home run, mm-hmm. But, you know. Still a good feeling.
But your objective is to, you know, change minds and
right.
change, you know, their thought values. So I think, yeah, that absolutely qualifies as something.
Yeah.
So you said you don't do a lot with digital. Anything that you would like to do with digital if it was available?
Every single, like, I would like to do 2D games, 3D games, VR games, build cave environments. Like, I'm, like, such a huge technologist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think technology can solve all the world's problems, but
right.
I think that it's really good for some things.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to create, like, VR experiences where you can, mm-hmm. you know, experience or attempt to experience someone's life to build empathy. And I think VR is an excellent way to do that. If I could get a headset somewhere.
One of the people in this space is Mike Block, who's working on VR Chicago.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they're working on a VR version of that game right now.
Yes. I need to...
I don't know if that's
public. Can you give me the 2-minute plug on VR Chicago?
It's basically like a day in the life game where you play as like a high schooler about to graduate in the south side of Chicago, and you live in like a high crime neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and you're basically like trying to keep your little sister out of danger, and also like you have a friend who's maybe considering joining a gang and stuff like that. So it's really like a slice of life
mm-hmm.
kind of thing for building empathy and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, putting people in shoes that they might not otherwise occupy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's going to be really effective in how we are.
When the game comes out, buy it.
Well, I just got to see about getting an HTC Vive, right?
Oh, yes. For Google Cardboard.
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing some good things.
If you have a Galaxy Gear or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
That's another thing. Samsung... Isn't that the same as Google Cardboard? I'm not really...
So Google Cardboard is more so like... this cardboard device that you can put your phone in.
Yeah, that's...
But then there is, like, a Samsung device that's...
It's the phone, but
yeah.
It goes in, like, maybe a more manufactured headset thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's...
Google Plastic. Or Alphabet Plastic? I don't know these days anymore.
But those Samsung phones have to run Android, right?
Right, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I use
I'm
Samsung S5 in Google Cardboard.
Okay.
So, yeah. Very strange.
It's a blurry line for me.
Yeah. I don't know what's happening.
They need to market this better so that... I mean, I'm a game developer and I don't know what
the
difference is.
The most I know is Facebook and Oculus.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the price point is difficult right now.
Yes.
Oh,
in the
yes.
fact that, you know, you need to buy this, what, 800, 900 piece of hardware and then buy a $2,000 PC to, yeah...
Right. And that's one reason why I like the idea of Google Cardboard is that they're bringing it to the masses. And it's, yeah, so a lot of people can start to experience VR. I think my major kind of quite actual question for VR is less about the price point and
mm-hmm.
even Google Cardboard, but like who's actually making experiences for this VR technology to actually you know, make it more than just a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we had devices like, you know, Kinect and, you know, PlayStation Move, and people viewed them, oh, they're, you know, they're a new hot thing, and where are they now? Not as popular as they could be, because right. no one was really creating these experiences for them.
Experiences that could only be had.
Exactly. And also what people wanted. Mm. And so I like the idea of VR, but I'm like, so what's the VR game?
Right.
What are we doing?
Yeah, I think part of what we ended up with is that a lot of people built like Kinect gimmicks on top of regular games, which just they felt like gimmicks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up with a few things like
voice does seem like kind of a game changer for me.
Yes.
Not to overuse the term.
No, please. Use the term. So many times.
But yeah, like, I don't know. Voice interaction for me is like so underrated, and it's growing so much. And like I have an Amazon Echo at home, and I have Siri on my phone, and like I just love using those voice assistants.
So I think voice is one of the things.
And Kinect also had the voice.
That it took a while, right? Because I remember when I was in college, right? Everyone was like, oh yeah, voice recognition is the next big thing. We're going to do all these voice recognition programs. And they just weren't good enough, right?
I'm privileged to have a kind of neutral American accent.
Right.
There's definitely, you know, if you have any kind of an accent, it really fouls up that software.
Yeah.
I mean, other than the, like, standard American.
Yeah. I'm also having a very neutral, like, Midwest accent.
Uh-huh.
But I have friends with strange names, which makes Siri, interacting with Siri, like, really difficult sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think voice is one of the things, like, and this is 10 years ago. Everyone was talking that voice was going to be, like, a huge breakout thing. And the tech just wasn't good enough yet.
Mm.
And then now I think we're finally getting to the point where the technology's up to the point where anyone can build voice recognition, or anyone can utilize voice recognition software that's pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
85, 95. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can just plug that into whatever.
So I think the new technologies have to get to that point before they really start making a difference. Because it's really frustrating when the technology doesn't work, right?
Right.
Right.
When I'm trying to do something in the game and I'm doing the right action,
I think that might be
pick up.
Why they recommend such a high-spec computer. Like, the Oculus can obviously run on something less than what they suggest. Like, you know, DK1 and 2 have been out for a while, and people...
Yeah.
But when you drop a frame in VR, it's way worse than dropping a frame on a screen, because you're, like, in it.
Yeah.
It's like reality just dropped out for a minute.
Yeah.
You can get motion sick.
Well, the other thing, someone like was, I read an article on the math of it, right? And basically, VR has to project to two screens instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you want to increase the resolution, it's actually a fourfold increase in the processing power that you need. So I think a lot of it is going to be like our technology needs to get better than it is right now, better and cheaper and lighter and so forth, but
fast, cheap, and out of control.
Yeah.
Woo. I don't know. I'm still, as much as I like VR, I would hope that augmented reality is still a thing. As much as everyone hated Google Glass, I thought it could be pretty cool, and I'm actually surprised at how much people are. It seems like they're excited about Microsoft HoloLens, and I'm like, but
just
did this, and you call them all glass holes. But I think there's the distinction is that with HoloLens, it's meant for like your private kind of life. You're not supposed to leave the house.
Mm-hmm.
Where Google Glasses, you're supposed to, and you kind of look like a total dork.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I just like I want augmented reality to be a thing.
Yeah.
I think it's so cool.
Absolutely.
We were just talking about how we're both really bad with names, and we really need those damn glasses to tell us like who someone is.
Yeah.
Yeah, when somebody walks up, just facial recognition, project a name tag onto their chest that only we can see, so they don't know we don't remember them.
Exactly.
And I think Facebook facial recognition is already there, so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely there. Kind of strange how it auto tags my friends, actually.
Mm-hmm. Creepy.
Just a little bit. But I'll be okay with it.
So any grand ideas in terms of, we talked about VR, but like Internet of Things, anything that you're considering with any kind of burgeoning new technologies?
Burgeoning new technologies? Outside of driverless cars, I just had a conversation with my Uber driver about driverless cars.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he speculates that Uber's goal is to just, you know, take over the road with driverless cars.
For sure.
And like, I was like, I can't disagree with that statement.
Well,
but,
I mean, it's in their like quarterly report. They
yeah.
have like a big, they have like an image of like the future of Uber, and it's just like a bunch of driverless cars all over.
Yeah, and I think that there is this narrative of technology, and that's why you see so many sci-fi narratives of like, oh, AI has consciousness and
mm-hmm.
then it takes over the world, which I don't know how a lot of data translates to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird jump, but
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
people, right? People think this way. And so I'm excited about driverless cars. I think it's a really cool idea. I'm just curious about how you would onboard people to be comfortable with driverless cars. That's
yeah.
actually my question. It's more social than it is technology.
Well, I saw an article that I think one of the Google cars got in an accident for the first time, which is, and you know,
and it was the other driver's fault.
Yeah.
The only driver's fault, I guess.
But they were saying, like, what happens when a driverless car, you know, kills somebody? You know, is it going to just kill the program? I think what's going to drive this, though, is just...
I'm sure people thought that about automobiles.
Yeah,
right?
No, automobiles were terrible. They killed tons of people.
Yeah.
And they still do.
But but the rich were people that had them.
Mm-hmm.
So they could cover up and, like, spread propaganda. And I think maybe that's the exact same thing.
Well,
that's
yeah, here's the thing. I think a lot of the push for driverless is going to be financial.
Mm.
So especially like trucking companies, right?
Mm.
One of their primary outlays is paying drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And when they don't have to pay drivers anymore and their insurance premiums go down, like that's going to be the first
and
push.
And when their vehicles don't have to stop for
right.
sleep. Or
yeah, don't have to stop for sleep. And yeah. So I think that's kind of the avenue that it's going to take. Is it,
oh
as you're
gosh.
Saying, like the people with the money are going to push this.
I was just thinking about you know how planes get refueled mid-flight now, some of them,
because
mm-hmm. There's like Air Force tankers that will like you know about this.
I didn't know this.
It's very
like, how is this happening?
It's very much a sexual metaphor. There's
what?
Like a tube that comes out of the front of the plane, and then there's like a net. That's attached to a tube, and the net goes on the tube, and they connect, and then
there's
fuel
an exchange
goes down.
Of...
yeah.
Does this happen while I'm sleeping on a plane?
No. It's not. It's like for Air Force.
Oh,
plane.
I was gonna.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was like, wait, this is a thing I've never seen.
I wish though, because I've been in some close calls where we're circling over the thing. I'm like, are we running out of fuel? But yeah, we could do that with trucks too.
Yeah, sure.
If it's like autonomous, they
oh,
could
yeah.
like
yeah.
you know, like Saya trucks could could have like a refueling vehicle that just drives in front of the truck. That would be crazy.
That would be crazy awesome.
It's gonna be a very very different world for the next couple of generations. I hope.
So I hear. That you're maybe doing some side projects. Can you talk about
I can totally
that?
Talk about some
All right.
projects. Yeah. So a couple of months ago, I just started an LLC called Sunflake Studios. We are really
nice.
Hyped about the name.
I think you probably got the best name out of anyone like in this area. We all pick terrible names.
Yeah.
So.
Luckily, it was my friend's idea. And,
okay.
and so he just told me, oh, we're naming it Sunflake Studios because that's what I wrote on it. And I was like, that's actually a great idea. Okay, because I'm terrible at names. And so we're currently working on a game called Project TX, and you're essentially a nanobot bot fighting diseases in the body.
Okay.
So it's a twin stick shooter.
Nice.
And so
Very
we're
cool.
hoping to put this on PS4 or Xbox, definitely PC, in the near future. So prototype maybe in August.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a lot work, just a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting. And it's now like, how do I balance my like job in the day? And then I come home and like, I'm still technically working. It's enjoyable because it's game design and I love games, but it's like, I'm still working. And right now I'm just in the design phase. And we realized, this game could potentially be educational. Maybe. I don't know.
That happens to me so often. I'm like, I just designed this, like, normal, fun game. That's cool. Wait a second. What if it was about Abraham Lincoln? Or, like, diseases or whatever, you know?
Right, yeah. And so, like, we don't... We're not, like, trying to, like, force, like, this is the lesson plan. This will be used here. But because the human body is... It's essentially systems within systems.
Right.
So what we're doing is, like, oh, okay, let's see what, you know, biologists have already, like, mapped out. So we're thinking, well, how do certain cells behave because we need AI in our game? And so I was like, wait. There are people who've already studied this. So I'm right now going through this large database called the Cell Behavior Ontology from Indiana University, figuring out how cells behave. It's absolutely fascinating.
That is very interesting.
But it's a lot of variables. And I'm like, I don't know if we need all of this. So, but it helps us actually just learn about what it is that we're trying to do. Yeah. So it's a lot to balance, but a lot of fun too.
Yeah, it's part of the magic of game design is taking like really complex systems and then making them so they are complex enough, but you don't have to do all the variables.
Faking some of it.
Yeah. Exactly. And some of the variables, right now, out of a database, I think of like 200 some variables. I only pulled out like 15 because I'm like, that is a very strange variable. I don't need that.
There.
Any plans for a Kickstarter at any point? That's our big pitch here, so.
Yeah, so we would like to do a Kickstarter. The two of us have never done a Kickstarter, so we're going to reach out to people who have done Kickstarters. Like, you guys have done some Kickstarters.
Maybe
But we're hoping to get a prototype up and running first so we can at least show off what the gameplay looks like before saying, hey, can you give us some money? Though, if you want to give us some money right now, that would be excellent. But, you know, yeah.
I think all of the Kickstarters that we've had on that have been successful have had some sort of demo or recorded gameplay when they went.
So that's why
I think you're doing exactly what you should do.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. So that's why we're thinking, okay, by August, that's a good 6 months. Like, we should be able to have something up and running by that point. And our... We'll have the entire game mapped out, but we definitely want to make sure, like, is this even fun? Like,
back to the question earlier,
is it fun? Even just, like, engaging, like, even if, because sometimes, like, I struggle with the word fun, because, like, sometimes when I'm playing, like, I don't know, playing The Witcher 3, and I'm searching for this obscure bear armor, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm having
this
fun,
sucks.
Right? But, like, I'm totally still here, like, it's hour 5, and I'm just like, okay. So are people engaged? Is there strategy? We'll see. And in August, it doesn't work. It's like, all right, scrap it.
The weird thing is when you get into like, so I briefly worked at a gambling games company and they used the word fun there. And I was always very skeptical. Like, does anyone ever have fun playing a gambling game? Or is it that we've just like, found a loophole in our limbic system that like forces people to continue on even though they're like miserable.
I went to a casino at one point in Ohio and like it's very weird gambling as a game designer because I know exactly what is happening in these systems and so it's just this weird meta moment of like I know for a fact I am not enjoying this. And I know for a fact that the system is working against me right now. And it was actually...
But its reward schedule is so satisfying.
Yeah, but for me it's kind of like because there's no real... Like, I prefer games that have a lot more skill with a little bit of randomness. That casino games never really appealed to me. But I could see all these people around just like so focused. And I'm like... all right, guys. I lost $20 in approximately 5 minutes. And I'm like, all right, that was, now I know. I've learned. But I hated it.
So we have only one recurring segment on the podcast.
We might bring one back.
We've been talking about bringing one back and maybe adding a new one. But as it stands right now, our one recurring segment is the What We're, which is just a recap of what we've been
consuming,
reading, playing,
basically.
Consuming
media.
In general.
Oh.
Media that we have been consuming. Do you want to go first?
Sure. So this is actually something you might be interested in. I've been reading a book called Peers Incorporated, and it's by the lady who founded Zipcar.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
a Wellesley grant.
Right. And it's all about the...
My wife points out.
It's about the power of kind of the peer network. What Airbnb does, right? What Uber does. What Zipcar does. And kind of like taking the idea and kind of harnessing the power of, I don't know, the population in general.
Having
right?
a good idea and then making your customers do it for you.
Well, it's kind of a two-way thing, right? Because it involves like you building a really good platform and then allowing your customers to essentially become like partial owners in that, you know, like when you're an Uber driver, you pick up fares, right? You decide when you're going to work. When you're Airbnb,
you pay insurance on your vehicle. You pay repair costs.
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely like this is part of the tension, right, between like platform owners and platform users. But it's an interesting idea of like what's going to happen in the future, right? Are we going to have the typical like corporate structure we have now, or are more things going to shift into kind of this like peer distributed model?
I wonder if just the saving grace of all these things is that like Americans resist unionizing for as long as they can, whereas like in Eastern Europe, like how do you even do Uber? They're gonna form a union and then start negotiating the prices, and then it'll be too expensive. It'll basically be a cab service. And then...
Well, so the interesting thing about peer-driven platforms, right, is that if you have a bad platform, no one uses it.
Yeah, so, TaskRabbit is that like, kind of crash and burn of one of those platforms. It's like
right.
they're trying to get people to do random tasks for people, like pick up their laundry or whatever. And apparently, like, they really abuse these people. And
yeah, and
so
if you have a bad platform, like, why would you use it? Yeah. So, if you think about it, it's a somewhat better model than like, the corporate model, because right now, like, if I do anything that my company like has forbade me to do, they just cut me, right? And there's really no repercussion for them. But if like, and there was an example specifically for Airbnb where they did something on the site where I think they took out the total number of reviews for hosts, and the host just like rebelled and they said like, we need that back. And because Airbnb completely depends on people to basically use their platform, they were forced to put that back in.
Yeah.
So it does provide at least a little more leverage than the current corporate structure that we have now. So it's an interesting concept. The other thing I did was I binged season 4 of House of Cards, which was fun. And I was telling Rob, like, when House of Cards like first came out, it was like revolutionary in the way like you could watch a whole season of it, and they had like these, you know, like movie actors in it, and it was really like well produced. And now we've become so used to it that it's still good, but it doesn't feel revolutionary anymore. And the other interesting part is they're doing. Go ahead.
Don't they play video games in that?
Kevin Spacey does.
Yeah. He plays Monument Valley and then Agario?
I think so.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The other interesting thing is they're running this season during election year. And I just imagine their writers were trying to think of like the craziest thing that could happen in an election. And they didn't even get close to like how crazy the real life election is. So I imagine that they're just being like, "What? No, we should have gone crazier, guys. We should have gone crazier."
Black Mirror, they did crazy.
They did crazy.
I heard good things about that.
I'm a big fan of Charlie Brooker,
mm-hmm.
who's the head writer and is mostly a comedy writer.
Really?
Yeah, like he has a show called, oh, I can't recall. It's like the week. It's just like a news recap kind of thing, like the Daily Show, but mm-hmm. like way more pessimistic and like angry. Yeah, it's really funny. Yeah.
All right, so...
Shall I go?
Go ahead.
So you have more time to prepare?
Oh, sure, yeah. Cool.
I just don't want to put you on the spot.
I appreciate you.
Thank you. I got another Comics Bento box.
Nice.
Oh.
Which I really wish was another sponsor. can we work on that?
Yeah,
get
absolutely.
Comics Bento box
absolutely.
As a sponsor. But yeah, they sent, actually maybe not because I'm gonna criticize them a little bit. It was mostly stinkers this month, except for one that was you know Alice Cooper, the rock
yep.
and roll star.
Mm-hmm.
They have a word for that, rock star.
edit that part.
So there's like a fantasy comic book where he stars as the Lord of Nightmares, and there's like
yes.
children that are being like targeted by a demon, and he has like a bad contract with like a demon who is also a music producer. And
I always suspected this.
Yes, sorry, Philip Morris, we're on to you. And it's really cool. Like, I don't know, I like Alice Cooper's music, and now that he's like a fantasy like Lord of Nightmares, it's really awesome, and it really fits thematically because he's always been like, you know, a bit goth,
just a bit.
And yeah, I don't know, it just worked together, and it's like, wow, this it's like a believable layer of supernatural reality that could coexist with our own, I guess. You know, believable is a is a sliding scale, but like I was able to suspend my disbelief for that comic book. It was good stuff.
All right.
I feel like I've done like a lot of things in the last week, kind of in preparation because I'm going to go to GDC. But in terms of games, I just finally got to start playing the Banner Saga, which is game that I've
mm-hmm.
always wanted to play. It is very pretty, and just off the
mm-hmm.
bat. And even though I knew going in that it's a tactical RPG, I did not start off playing it as a tactical RPG, such that all my characters just started dying. I'm just like, I had to start the game over. Because I'm like, I'm doing this so wrong.
Were you playing it more for story in the beginning?
I think so. And so when the battles happen, I'm like,
mm-hmm.
okay, moving up. And I'm like, oh, wait, no, okay, I get it. So, restart. Played it more like a tactical RPG. I'm only in the first part of it. I've only played it for a good, like, hour, 2 hours.
Okay.
So that's one game that I've been playing.
Mm.
I also started playing The Witness.
Mm.
Also very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I also realized that it is a game that I cannot play for extended periods of time.
Because
okay.
I don't think I can handle like puzzles after puzzle after puzzle in like rapid succession.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more like I will play this game for 30 minutes, I will solve 5 puzzles, and then I will leave, and you know, this is something I just do to decompress at the end
mm-hmm.
of the day.
Yeah.
So those are two games that I just started playing, and I think they're absolutely fascinating.
That's interesting in terms of consumption, because so we talked about the Netflix model where they just dump like all like a full season and you can binge it.
Mm-hmm.
No one really discusses about whether games should be binged or not, right? Like, no one said, like, oh, you should play Call of Duty over 2 weeks instead of, you know, beating it in 3 nights or something.
It's so, I feel like, depending on the type of game it is, so I really love open world RPGs. That's
mm-hmm.
just, like, my jam. So anytime a new game comes out, or really also narrative heavy games, when they come out, I binge play them for a good like week. Mm-hmm. Like, I live with my sister, and my sister knows that, oh, this, you know, like for instance, like Fallout 4, when it came out, yep. She was like, new, for the next, like, 7 days, I'm just going to be sitting on my couch and mm-hmm. playing this game. You can talk to me, but I'm focused. Right? So I binge that game.
Yep.
But then there are certain games, like puzzle games and platformer games, which, you know, I like, but I don't like them as much as mm-hmm. open world RPGs. So I get frustrated really quickly, and so it's like, all right, let me manage my own expectations, because I don't want my own frustration to get in the way of me liking this game. Because I don't want to say, like, oh, I'm so frustrated, I hate this game, and then never play it. Because
right.
I know it's not the game's fault. It's my own fault, because I'm not...
So
it's not my favorite type of game.
Something we've talked about before on the show is decision fatigue.
Mm.
And that affects me quite a lot. Like, I mean, I guess that's... pretty bad quality in a game designer is to have to easily be susceptible to decision fatigue, because it's all about decision making. But yeah, I find myself able to play games that require very few like decisions for long, long periods of time. Like
mm-hmm.
I can play an FPS for super long periods of time
mm-hmm.
because there's no decisions to be made. It's like, oh, there's a dude there that needs to get shot. I'll
mm-hmm.
shoot him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, yeah, but puzzle games I have to put down because, you know, I've just made a choice, or, like, you know, so anything with permanent consequences for, like, your party,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to, like, let a decision sink in for a while before
exactly.
I come back to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I know, like, in RPGs, when I know a critical moment is about to happen,
mm-hmm.
I'm that person who's just, like, if this was, like, if you were a character in this world, it'd be very strange, because my character's just staring at you for, like, 40 minutes, because I'm not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, that person just sitting on the couch, like, what if I make the wrong decision? What if, you know, this alien race decides, like, after I make this decision, that they're going to, like, attack me? Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
just, like,
mm-hmm.
hypothetically. So I'm, like, very, like, scared about the choices that I make. So, yeah, decision fatigue is so very real. And even more so when the game actually shows the effect
yeah.
Down the road. Yeah. But with, like...
Even if you're choosing, like, even minor things, like, I just equipped, like, a long-range weapon, and now I'm in, like, little hallways, like, that
yeah.
was terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
I regret everything.
Yeah. Or, like, oh, man, I just leveled up, here's a skill point.
God,
what type
yeah.
of character?
Oh,
am
yeah.
I, what type of character am I actually going to create? I realize this in...
Sometimes I just make Courtney, my wife. Do it. It's just like, I got a skill point, what should I do?
That's so smart. So, like, the first, like, 5 to 10 hours I was playing Fallout, I realized that I did not thoroughly think through the type of character I was trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
I put a lot of my points into charisma, because I thought, you know, I was thinking in a very, like, D&D sort of manner,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
oh, I can, like, talk my way out of all situations,
mm-hmm.
or I'll be, like, more attractive. I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized,
when
like...
a monster from the desert is gonna, like, fall in love with you. That would be an amazing thing if those, like, radiated scorpions were just like, oh...
That's exactly it. I was hoping for something, and then I realized I don't have any strength, so I'm not a good melee fighter. I suck at ranged weapons, and I suck at pistols. What am I doing? I'm just a sneaky, charismatic character. What?
Her realm.
I was trying to be, but Fallout is not the... They don't take well to, like,
yeah,
rogues.
Yes.
So I had to put in more points for pistols, but it was just, like, this moment where... I started.
See, I think that's a game design flaw. I think the game is
not so
good.
You know,
I 100%
the,
so
the original Fallout, that would have been a totally valid way to
yes.
play.
Yes. But then it was those moments where I'm like, okay, no, this is not the type of game this is.
Mm-hmm.
And now I really have to think critically
mm-hmm.
about every skill point I get.
Yeah.
But I wish I could just go through the game with, like, 10 points of charisma,
mm-hmm.
and, like, I don't have to fire a gun because I'm like, halt, I'm very charismatic. Stop whatever it is that you're doing. Give me your money and your weapons. Leave. Like,
would you shoot a face like this?
Exactly. Like, look at my face. Look at my phone.
I can't sting that.
Exactly.
Or at least, like, get a party of really dangerous people to follow you and, like,
exactly.
do the fighting for you
mm-hmm.
because you're such a charismatic leader.
That's what I was hoping. Mm. That is false.
Yeah.
FYI.
Well, and
Bethesda,
like,
failed.
Get it together, Bethesda. Though I still love you.
Yeah.
Keep making games.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, the fact that you're a game designer, you can actually recognize that, like, this game wasn't designed for this. But, like, as a player, think about how, like, angry you'd be, like, not understanding mechanics, just be like, why did the game let me do this, like, terrible thing? And now I'm having a terrible time because I'm supposed to, you know, I had this idea that I was going to be all charming, and now I'm just getting eaten by scorpions.
Well, hopefully, I mean, the game gives you feedback about it, right? Like, if you keep having to restart because you keep getting killed.
Well, the thing about a game like Fallout, you won't figure out till you're, you know, 5 hours in that this is not viable.
Yeah, you could probably spend quite a few hours in the game on this path, and until you start to try and complete the story, then you realize, oh, this character build was terrible.
Oh, because they make you do fetch quests to continue the story?
Yeah, and then, like, when you're exploring, you meet this other person, and then they say, oh, hey, you want to, like, join my faction? And I'm like, oh, sure, why not? And so there's just, like, all these different side quests that, you know, actually work for the different builds that you have.
Mm.
But then your main quest doesn't allow for that. You have to be this, you know, gun-toting or, like, melee, like, smashing character. And it's like, oh, well.
There's a big problem with that. And I don't know, it brings me back to Deus Ex. The new one, Human Revolution, where
I was so upset.
I was, like, very much into sneaking and just,
yes,
like, not doing any combat.
Never shot a person.
And then there's, like, set pieces, boss battles, where you basically, there's no way to beat it with stealth.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I was like, is this gun doing anything? Like, oh, it was like the tranquilizer gun. Like, oh, you're not falling asleep. Okay, well, I don't have any points to punch you because I'm trying to stealth my way around.
So, do you want to hear the really interesting, like, reveal?
It's a different company.
Yeah, they're outsourced. That's why the boss battles are so terrible, because they were built by a different company that wasn't part of the
program. Why would they outsource it? In fact, why did they even need the boss battles?
For the emotional roller coaster of it, I guess.
Which emotional roast?
Who did it great was Dishonored, though. There were stealth options for absolutely everything.
Oh, Dishonored was so good. Like, it just, yeah. You tell me
that. Sequel's coming soon.
Yep.
Woo! Pre-ordered. Acquired. I pre-ordered probably too many games, but I'm excited by them.
I don't buy games until right before I'm going to play them.
That's smart.
See, I'm even worse. I'll wait till, like, I see a video review, and then I'll be like, alright, fine, I'll buy this.
I don't know. I pre-order, like, a lot of my games, so then when they appear at my house, I'm like, oh, okay, it's,
sweet.
I don't know, it's Uncharted 4 Day, great! Let me just play this for a couple of hours, and yeah.
Me and Rob, like, before you were having this discussion, I had a buddy who used to drunk Kickstarter. So he would just, like, go on Kickstarter and back random projects while he was drunk and just have no idea that he did it.
As creators, we should really encourage that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we were actually talking about this thing called, like, what is it, Kickstarter Binge Mode, where it just shows you projects and you just, like, hit yes or no.
And you can set,
like, Tinder, like, swipe left or right.
Yeah.
There would be an account setting where it's, like, what's the most I can spend per day or something.
Right.
So
that's
ethical.
I like that. I like that.
But
yeah,
so,
it's like Kickstarter binge mode, and you just, like, click a bunch of things, and then, like, 10 months later, you just get, like, these random, like, goodie bag figures.
Poster, t-shirt, game.
Well, what's
sous vide?
Why did I buy this?
I can generate my own power using running water.
what's a whisk? Why would I buy a whisk?
Yeah. Well, we are definitely doing a long episode here, but we should have you back on for whenever that Kickstarter gets fired up.
Yeah,
so.
Sometime in August, September, you'll see me. You'll see me around. You'll be like, oh my god, what have I done? I'll be crawling from a dark hole, finishing the prototype. Like, oh, it is done. bleh.
This would be a good time to give a shout out to our sponsors.
Absolutely. So our two sponsors at current are InnoPrints for all your printing and promotional needs. If you were doing such a thing.
GC's coming.
Yep, GC's coming. So if you need those fancy new cards.
It's InnoPrints.com
and use the code CGS to get 10% off your first order.
Sweet.
And it is tax season. So a good time for all you small entrepreneurs to find a good accountant.
Not that you're small, but maybe your business is small.
Yeah, it's a very general term these days. But our good friend at Marty at
Must be this tall to get taxes. No.
Our good friend Marty at General Ledger is our guy for all things tax related.
Yes.
He does
literally true. He does our taxes.
And he has a great blog called Pocket Marty, if you're interested in just picking up a little
tidbits of advice.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you give him a call and mention the CGS pod, you'll be qualified for a free half-hour consultation.
Yes. Well worth it, yep. My humble opinion.
So, do you want to plug anything in addition?
No, actually, I think...
Where can we find the Game Changer Lab on the interwebs?
You can go to... you just actually... We're in the process of redesigning our website. So, if you Google Game Changer
By
Chicago,
the time this gets on iTunes...
It won't be pretty.
Oh, it won't be ready.
It won't be ready.
Okay.
I will guarantee... It's a university.
Universities.
It's a university, bureaucracy, all that jazz. You know, you learn to deal with it. But if you Google Game Changer Chicago, we will be the first thing that comes up. That is our old website. But it will give you some information there.
All right.
Yeah.
And you're Ashlyn Sparrow
I'm
on Twitter, right?
Oh, yes. I keep it really simple on my social media. Always Ashlyn Sparrow. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. Just, it's always Ashlyn Sparrow.
Ashlyn with a Y.
Yes. Ashlyn. That's it.
And there's no question mark.
No question mark. No question mark. No underscore. No exclamation marks.
Mm.
Sparrow, like the bird, or the captain.
Mm.
There you go.
Fanciest.
But yeah. And I'm Q1Hong, at Q1Hong on Twitter, and my game is Contract Work on Facebook at Contract Work Game.
And I'm Rob Lockhart, or Bobby Locks, at Bobby Locks with an X, and BobbyLocks.com.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.